Welcome to Refugee Radio.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Refugee Radio Show. This programme is being broadcast to mark the end of the National Refugee Week and the culmination of the end of the last phase of our Community Resilience Project. This was a project funded by Time to Change Mental Health Discrimination Campaign. One of our goals was to educate people about refugee mental health issues, and so I went with one of our volunteer panel members and workshop leaders to visit the Global Health MSc students at Brighton and Sussex Medical School to talk about this issue. During the show today, you will hear some recordings from that discussion, and then you have the opportunity to get involved in the discussion yourself. Immediately following the broadcast from 9 o'clock this evening, there will be a live question and answer session on our Facebook page with members of the Community Resilience Panel. You can post anything you want to ask them about this programme or about the campaign to end the stigma around mental health. Those of you listening to a repeat of this programme or to the podcast can still post questions up to the end of June, and we will be checking in every day.
My name is Matthias, and I'm originally from Angola. It's southeast African country. That my country was in conflict actually for 27 years, and it was colonized by Portugal. So,
do you tell people about a little bit about what you're doing with refugee?
I actually completed my master's degree with Sussex. Yeah, in September, in international trade law, and I met Steve when I applied for a volunteer work, because I'm very interested to deliver to the communities in Sussex, you know, about the awareness of post-traumatic stress disorder, and because there is a stigma and discrimination against refugees and asylum seekers, as Steve mentioned before. Yeah, and then so with this volunteer work, actually, I, you know, developed a lot of skills, and I went deep and understanding more about the system and about the what actually post-traumatic disorder is. And because it was just depression, because I was misdiagnosed when I first arrived in this country, and then that's why I had it affected me, and then that's why I found that, you know, I decided to volunteer with his organization, because I was interested to understand more about what post-traumatic disorder actually is, PTSD, let me call it PTSD. Yeah, and then I now have got a picture that, you know, what that can cause to a person if you are not treated or if you are misdiagnosed by the doctor. So, I'm very happy to work with him, actually.
And you're volunteering with Mind now, aren't you?
Yeah, and in Mind as well. And, I had a training with Mind as well, how to address the issue of a mental health problem. And, you know, not just that, because mental health problem, I also found that mental health problem is not just into refugees and asylum seekers or migrants, even also citizens from this country, those who have been working full time, for example. Mine told me that in six employers, one is affected by mental health problem because of the demand, the pressure into the work placement. Yeah. It was a very, very good experience.
So yeah, we've been asked to come and talk about refugee healthcare. I think that's the topic. We're going to be talking a fair bit about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Some people say PTS because they don't like the
the D. They don't like to refer to it as a disorder, but anyway, yeah. PTSD is the standard term for it. We're going to be talking about PTSD because I think that is above and beyond the primary healthcare issue for refugees and asylum seekers, certainly that we've come across and certainly that we're looking at the moment. One of the reasons this jumps out, there are other issues, sure, there's things, people coming from conflict areas, there's issues of HIV, there's issues of tuberculosis and things like that, but PTSD jumps out because it's so frequently misdiagnosed. I think that's the main problem. When somebody has HIV or somebody has tuberculosis, or sometimes people aren't thinking to check for TB, but once you do a rudimentary check, you're going to pick it up. But PTSD, it's just not getting... It just, as a diagnosis, it might as well not exist for most people. And the problem, of course, with it not being diagnosed correctly is that it's then not being treated. And we were talking about this earlier. The difference between post-traumatic stress disorder and other mental illnesses is that PTSD is largely curable or treatable, as opposed to a whole bunch of other things which kind of aren't. They're just manageable. So you have a relatively treatable, relatively curable condition, not actually getting looked at all. Obviously, there's a problem for the individual who has an undiagnosed health issue, but I think there's a public health issue around it. Certainly, with PTSD, it's something I've come across more working with veterans in the British Armed Forces. It's issues of substance misuse, issues of alcohol misuse. It's less of a factor with refugees and asylum seekers. Generally, I think they're just better behaved. I also work with children and young people, and it's the British-born children are the ones with the substance misuse issues, not the unaccompanied asylum-seeking children, generally. But certainly substance abuse and alcohol are factors. Domestic violence is a factor, potentially arguably a public health issue. Suicide, self-harm. Also insomnia, which is one of the big symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, is potentially a public health issue. There is a general inability of services to respond to the health needs of refugees, broadly, kind of at all points of access, but there's also a lack of specialist services, which we'll get into. Another big factor is the stigma and taboo. There's not just... our project's part of the Time to Change campaign, which is around destigmatising mental health illness in the UK. But that's one thing. It's bad. It's basically a big enough stigma here, but if you're talking people from other countries, some countries where it's almost literally criminalised to have a mental health issue. Or I say mental health to some people, and they include, they think of a spectrum including Down syndrome or, you know, things that we wouldn't actually consider mental health issues necessarily. So people really don't want to identify as having a lived experience of mental health issues. So we've got the stigma and taboo from the home country. We've also got a lack of knowledge of what PTSD is individually and on a community level. There's no real understanding of it. For us, there's a big question of resilience. Possibly this emerges from having worked with young people for the past few years, and the concept of resilience is one that we found very useful in designing our interventions. But there's also a question of post-traumatic resilience, the idea that people, survivors of trauma are in some sense possibly tougher, even though they might appear to not be coping as well with smaller issues. The fact is they are the survivors, and that there is perhaps some form of resilience to be found in the the aspect of being a survivor. I'm going to talk briefly about the evidence of need, and then I want to talk a little bit about detention. We don't work very much in detention. I don't have a lot to do with people in immigration detention, but it's a very good place to start talking about refugee health, because for a lot of people it's the first experience they have in the UK. For some people it's the only experience they have in the UK, and it frames very much the refugee relationship to healthcare, because it's the beginning point is from less than zero, really. In terms of evidence of need, Refugee Radio were involved with a beneficiary-led needs assessment of refugees and asylum seekers in Sussex in 2012. The main gaps in service provision identified were health and support services for those with mental health needs. This gap is particularly acute in East Sussex, where, quote, it was putting a strain on services and having a damaging effect on those in need, preventing them from integrating and leading a normal life. It's entitled Refugees and Asylum Seekers, Sussex Needs Assessment. Refugees are nearly twice as likely to experience mental health problems than the average person. I get that from a whole bunch of places, including No Health Without Mental Health, the cross-government mental health outcome strategy from the Department of Health last year. PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is especially prevalent as a result of torture, sexual violence and war in people's home countries. That's from a slightly older book, actually, called A Shattered World, The Mental Health Needs of Refugees and Newly Arrived Communities, from the Migrant and Refugees Communities Forum. Refugees are not accessing mainstream mental health services. They're not accessing counselling or other intervention services in the main. GPs and community mental health teams feel they lack the expertise to deal with PTSD. And that's from a Civilised Society mental health provision for refugees and asylum seekers in England and Wales, published by Mind a couple of years ago. And that's GPs and community health teams themselves reporting that they basically don't know what they're doing with refugees. They just feel they don't get what's happening with PTSD. They're out of their depth. Refugees and asylum seekers are often turned away from mainstream treatment due to questions about their status. I don't know if you've ever had this, trying to get a GP, and the receptionist is like, where's your passport? And have you had that?
That was very difficult, because I just was released from the prison, and then I was sent to Portsmouth by the government, and when I went to the front desk with a letter, they said, where is your passport? Do you have any document that can prove that you have got the right to have access into, the National Health Services? And I said, no, I have only this letter from the Home Office. They didn't understand. They didn't want to even, register my details. And it was very difficult. I had to contact the nurse. The nurse was the Home Office. It's part of the Home Office as well. And then they had to contact the GP, to tell them, he's an asylum seeker. It is very, very difficult to become an asylum seeker or refugee. Because I had to leave because my parents, my mom, my dad were assassinated, and my sister disappeared. So when I was 12 years old, and then I witnessed, actually, the assassination of my parents. So, and when I was 15 years old, I had to leave the country. I didn't want to stay there because they wanted me to join to the army. And I spoke to my uncle. And then also realized that if I joined this blood war that killed my parents, so I can be dead as well. Because I don't think I would be, in that time, I would be able to, take a gun and go and kill people from the same country we were killing. That was civil war between the rebels and the government. And then I spoke to my uncle. I told him, look, I need to leave this country. You need to send me somewhere outside of this country. And then he decided to send me to Brazil. I lived in Brazil for... When I arrived in Brazil, I had no one in Brazil. It was just like 15 years old guy, boy. And then, so I had to stay to live in the street for three months. I was actually lucky. And then when I was 15 years old, I started to feel the symptoms. Hallucinations, anger against those people who killed my parents. I really was a terrible person. Very angry person. I used to live in the street of Rio de Janeiro. I used to sleep in the, under the bridge with another Brazilian, actually kids, until. That's why I say I'm lucky, until I found a family that found interested in, look after me. They take me from the street, and then taking me from the street, and they put me And I explained to them that, look, I think I have got some problems. They said, no, go to the church. And I said that, I told them, look, I have got mental, I think it's mental. And I told them, look, I hear voice of my mom. And then sometimes, you know, I get angry very easily, no friendships. And they said, yeah, that's easy because they are Christian family. They advised me to actually go to the church and find a girlfriend. But none of that helped. And because Brazil is like, I don't think they take it very seriously in this kind of, you know, mental health problem, especially PTSD. I didn't know that I had PTSD until I came to England. And then, so I went to school. I managed to complete my secondary school. They are like my second family. I really love them. But unfortunately, I was coming from work, and then I was attacked by the police in Brazil. It was in 2004. And then I was actually seriously ill. I just found myself in the hospital until they forced a parent from Brazil. You know, they came, and then they didn't even know as well, because the police took me somewhere, like in the forest. And to be honest, I slapped the police. I attacked the police first. That's why they treated me that way. They even want to kill me. I'm lucky that I was not dead. I don't know where the person came from and called the ambulance. And then I just found myself in the hospital, to be honest. And then when I left the hospital, I called them Mama and Daisy, my foster mom. And then I told her, look, I can't stay in this country anymore. I need to leave Brazil, otherwise I'm going to be dead. And then I have got these problems. I don't know what's going wrong with me, so you are not understanding me. I need to leave. Because I was advised that if you go to Europe, especially England, you can be treated. You can be, because in this country they take more seriously. Yeah, I came here in 2004. But I came here with a passport because they helped me to get into the plane. Living in Brazil, then when I arrived here, I was arrested. I went to prison. That's immigration matter. For me, when I saw the handcuffs, when they took me into the detention center, I just said, wow, that's the end of the world. For me, that was really, and yeah, I went to the magistrate court, because they accused me that you came here without a passport, you are applying for asylum in this country. And it is an offense, you know, enter without a passport. I understand, but I came here for help because I need it. And then each country have got their rules. I understand. I now understand that. I couldn't understand before. Yeah, until a lawyer came to see me. In the detention, because the magistrate said we cannot decide your case because there is a law accusation against you. We are gonna refer you to the prison. I've never been in prison in my life before. That was the first time. It was in London. I even forgot the name of it. I even don't want to remember the name of the prison, to be honest. And they throw me into the middle of serious criminals. So people with the terrible behavior. To be honest, I didn't want to eat for about, I think I stayed there because they gave me a cell, alone, TV, you know, everything there. I didn't want to communicate, I didn't want to eat. I stayed for about, I think, 5 days without eating. Yeah, because I just tried to, you know, to disappear. I didn't want to leave anymore. Came here in this country for help, and then they arrested me. So yeah, until a lawyer came to see me. I couldn't speak a word of English when I first arrived. And then and the lawyer, they were announced that, Matias, there is someone who wants to see you. I was not understanding, it was everything in English. And then the officer came. I think they are calling me. I think there is someone waiting for you in the reception. I started to understand the basics. Yeah, I went there and then I met the lawyer. She said, I will be your lawyer, criminal lawyer. So then I felt more confident to tell her about my health problem. Because I didn't trust the police from this country when I first arrived because of the trauma that I faced by what happened in Brazil, what the police did to me. I just thought that all of them are the same. And then, so she said, oh, that's very serious. I explained to her about my parents, what happened in Brazil. She said, I will refer you to the magistrate court where there is the 12 juries and the judge so that they would be able to understand it. She did. And then I went to, in December the 21st, 2004, I went to the court. They took me from prison to court. And then she advised me to plead guilty. Because I was guilty. I can hear that documents, I understood that. She said, say guilt, don't say not guilt. Then I did, I could understand the word guilt that time. I played guilt. And then the barrister, she was not there. The barrister had to read the statement about all of my journey. And the accusation barrister also came as well. He said, no, he came here in this country, applied for asylum, I can't stay here. The judge said, you need to release him. They need to be released as soon as possible. And I think I was, I'll never forget, I was released on the 24th of December, which is one day for Christmas. So from there, I started to the asylum application. I went to my medical foundation. I think medical foundation was the one they misdiagnosed, started from the medical foundation. Because when I had the assessment, he said that I will write to you, explain, because I had to explain about the attack in Brazil and about my parents. And then he sent a letter. He said, we believe that you need the psychological help. He did not refer that I have got depression or I have got PTSD, no. So when I was sent to Portsmouth by the nurse, then I received a letter from the GP to see them, that there is one appointment for me. And I went to see her. She said, we suspect that you have got depression, but I'm going to refer you to St. John Hospital. It's a mental health unit. I had another assessment. It was like, go here and explain again, and go there and explain all of it. I used to get very angry. I didn't want really to talk about that. I now feel comfortable to talk, because before, no, I couldn't talk about it. Yeah, so then they gave me citalopram. I started to take citalopram from there. It helped a bit. It helped me. I started to get sleep and get less angry. Until I was asked to go for the interview in Liverpool, the asylum claim interview. That takes 2 hours, actually. I was not able to make it for the first time. I got very angry, I got hit on the table. Yeah, and then they had to stop the interview. And then the next one, I think it was after 6 months, 6 months after, yeah. And I went back again. My doctor instructed me. She told me, take your medication properly, answer the questions, don't get angry. It's not easy because they were questioning me in some things. They were not believing me. And therefore, I was very upset, very angry. But I managed to finish. Yeah, then they gave me the states after. He said, I'm going to write to you in 1 month. And then he did the Home Office, granted me refugee status straight away. But this did not stop me to learn. Even with that all of that problem, I had ambition. I always wanted to study. I always, want to go to university. Yeah, before even my parents died. And they knew that I wanted to go to the university. And I went. I went to the university. I went to, and I started to study when I went to Birmingham. I was not diagnosed yet by PTSD. I started to take Citalopram. That was just depression until 2009, when I went to study with London Metropolitan University. I met Karen Simpson. She's clinical psychologist. No, before leaving Portsmouth to London, I was advised by a healthcare advisor in Portsmouth. She said, when you go to London, I said, I'm not getting better. She said, actually, when you go to London, try to see a clinical psychologist. Don't go and ask your GP to refer you to a clinical psychologist specializing in trauma. And then that's why I went to see Karen. She is actually a very good professional. She went also to Rwanda during the genocide, and she saw terrible things there. She told me, and then I had to explain to her, and then she told me, there is no doubt that you have got post-traumatic stress disorder, but we will work on this, and then we will, you are going to get better. And I believed, so we managed to tackle some symptoms. And then I started to study more deeply. I started to get more good marks, sleeping better. So that I concluded my studies in 2011. And then I decided to go straight away and study my master's. I came here last year, completed my master. Now I'm much better, but I'm still getting counseling support with the Hanukkah Copper. It's like, I don't know if you heard about that, EMDR. This I'm taking now. It's like, sometimes I think it's I'm talking to you, but it's like it looks like everything's coming back again. But he said it's gonna be like that, but it's gonna be fine. So I'm thinking, finish course, that get better, get a good job, and live my life. Thank you very much.
EMDR is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
Yeah,
that's what it stands for. It's a treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. In your experience, it involves you have to hold on to like a thing.
Yeah, it is two different. It's a machine. It vibes. And then you have to think actually about the problem. I also was attacked in London last year. Someone tried to kill me. He attacked them. This is this is a bacteria from the skin. I had a tumor, big one, when I was in campus, off campus, down to the seafront. And then this attack, and the guy came behind me with the wine glass and then stick on me and then beating my finger, and all of the symptoms came back again. So that's why I came again to see the counseling. So I forgot even to mention about this. He's in prison for 4 years actually.
What's the difference between I think it's just gone into the new DSM, hasn't it? It's the difference between PTSD and complex PTSD. Is a complex PTSD is something when it's been a series of traumatic events or trauma that's taken place over a period of time. So I think it's called complex PTSD. It's more difficult to treat than PTSD. For example, somebody is in a car crash or something like that, or is in a traumatic incident. Whereas complex PTSD is more something that happens over a longer term.
He said that you are taking these the EMDR, but as I have got so many traumas. And then he said, we don't believe that all of them will be, resolved, especially the ones that, the assassination of my parents. I don't think I'll be able to forget about that, though. Because that was very serious. And, but the attack, I forgive him anyway, so the guy, I think the guy had a serious problem as well. The guy who attacked me, he needed help. I knew him, he was my friend. And he was a very strange person. Yeah, and he's originally from Congo. He grew up in this country, smoking, drinking, never want to study, very aggressive. And yeah, I started to identify, and then I went too far with that friendship. I just asked him to leave the computer, and I go home, and go home, because it was already like almost 2 a.m., and I want to sleep. He got mad on me, started to shout and calling me names. I got angry as well, and he attacked me, in my house. I had a bedroom flat. He attacked inside my house, and he ran away. It's like blood everywhere. I think he needed help. I forgive him, to be honest.
Yeah, EMDR is supposed to be, well, I don't know, you hear different things, and it's sort of emerging more as a treatment, but it's supposed to be more effective with more recent traumas than things that happened longer ago. I initially heard it was a window of 6 months, but I subsequently heard no, it can be things that happen within the entirety of a person's life.
You mean the one that happened recently? I think I still have got hearing, especially my mom. I used to think that my mom is somewhere here and somewhere calling me. So everything that happened sometimes comes to me. My sister disappeared, I don't know where she is. I tried to find her many times. I went to the Red Cross, and the Red Cross said, if we will find her, we will contact you. And I never heard from her, because she was older than me, and my mom was screaming and asked her to look after me. But we were running together, many people running. There was war, conflict. She disappeared. Don't know where she is.
Yeah, we should talk about the symptoms, because that kind of comes in under, kind of comes under flashbacks, doesn't it? PTSD is really, it's one of these things, it's a cluster of symptoms rather than a thing itself, and of course flashbacks is one, but it's not, flashbacks just simply means reliving the trauma. I don't know if any of you have seen First Blood, Rambo 1. It's not a very well respected film, but I rate it personally. It's the first time in a film that they've depicted flashbacks, and he's being maltreated by the police in America, and he starts having flashbacks to being a prisoner of war in Vietnam. Now it's kind of, it's a trope, it's a sort of thing people are, we're familiar with seeing it in an action film or a thriller or something, to see somebody having flashbacks and that being depicted. But it was actually relatively a new idea culturally. Flashbacks or reliving trauma is when a person is, one of the problems with traumatic memory is that it's to do with the way it's stored in the brain. It's not, it doesn't fade over time or become a memory properly. It's actually still a lived experience, and one of the problems is that when a person experiences it or thinks of it, it's as if it's happening right now. So it's the emotional content of it that's live, kind of, and it doesn't get processed properly. And one of the things with EMDR is about taking the traumatic memories and trying to reprocess them without that emotional content. But when a person experiences a flashback, they're right there. It's happening again, and people can see things or hear things that from the time. Flashbacks is not—it's not the only symptom. It's not actually an essential symptom. It's an essential symptom, but sometimes people think that if you don't have flashbacks, you don't have PTSD. But it's not. It doesn't always happen. It is very common. Sleep disorders, nightmares, insomnia, memory problems.
Concentration.
Yeah, memory problems. Yeah, includes. It's like problems recalling the event itself, the traumatic events, or problems concentrating, problems focusing, being able to retain, information, being irritable or angry. You spoke about being angry, and just kind of kicking off. And it's, you're not actually. I don't experience you anywhere as an angry person.
Yeah,
but it's sort of like an uncontrollable reaction, isn't it?
Cannot control sometimes.
Extreme alertness, or what's called hypervigilance, or an extreme startled response. That's very common as well. People are, because the sense that the trauma is still live, people with PTSD tend to remain very... it's not just about being tense, it's about being kind of overly alert, overly aware of what's going on, overly kind of you're ready for action, yeah. kind of at any time you're And if something bad does happen, like there's a fire or an accident of some kind, people with PTSD are great to have around normally because they're very calm because they're already there anyway. Everybody else starts freaking out, but they're already they already feel as if that sort of thing's happening the whole time. They've just kind of got used to it. Dissociation is probably a bit too complicated to go into, but it's does anyone know what dissociation is? It's kind of hard.
In what sort of context do you mean, like from situation?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to describe. It's a kind of it's like flashbacks in the sense that the person's not here, but it's about the person
disconnecting.
Outside, you think that. Outside of
it's like you're either so you can you, there's levels of it, so you can be like almost like actually projecting kind of thing, like you know, floating above your body watching it all happening, or you can just simply cease to exist mentally while it's happening. And then obviously suicidal ideation and self-harm are very common.
My name is Kiz. Thanks for sharing the story.
You're welcome.
Quite really good. You talked about the example of your friend from
Uganda.
Uganda.
Yes.
And there's always a fear of being when looking for asylum that you'll be sent back to your country. So you said you're from Angola.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there were times when you were approached healthcare or you approached the police in the UK.
Yeah.
Did you fear that they would send you back?
Did you have
that mistrust in yourself that they may?
Yeah, from that point.
Even though you were granted refugee status.
Yes, I was, because the country was not. My fear was that if they send me back, where am I going to stay? I have no relatives. And my parents, I left the country when I was very young. If they send me, where am I going to stay? And the country was in conflict at that time. That would be like a piece of cake for the government. They would take me and then they just send me to the war, to the conflict, and then, or maybe they would kill me in the detention center. And then my fight was, I was aware about that, because I remember that the immigration the interviewer, he told me, he said, no, your country is much better now. I think you can go back. I told him, you should go there, and you should go there and see. Yeah, and you know, it's very easy to say here. But I was born there, and that was really the challenge to send back. Yeah, because you don't know what can happen to you. I think that they granted me asylum just because of my health problem. Because I remember the Home Office requested medical reports from the Medical Foundation and the St. James Hospital in Portsmouth, the mental health, to prove that I actually have got this problem. Otherwise, I don't think they would allow me to stay in this country. Yeah.
Yeah, medical. It's true. Medical reports become they are a huge weapon, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you both for coming to speak to us. I wanted to ask you a question about these quite shocking statistics and numbers and horrible reports that are happening to these people in the detention centres. I don't know if it's my ignorance and I haven't seen it, but it's not something that I've come across in mainstream media. Mm. Is it just, I mean, obviously you're doing your bit to raise awareness with your refugee radio station, but, you know, how is it getting out to the masses in the UK? These reports, are they just not?
I think it's the difference between one isolated piece of information and the whole picture. I read For example, I read in the paper a couple of days ago about a police officer who was two or three times over the drink drive limit and had given a colleague a lift and had crashed. He was off duty. He'd just come off duty and he'd crashed and killed the passenger. But he survived. And the Crown Prosecution Service decided not to... they weren't going to press charges for manslaughter. So you think, oh, OK. In Iceland, and that was in The Guardian, it was a piece of national news. And it's an example, obviously it's a different type of thing, but it's an example of something, you see that in isolation, you think, OK, that's a bit odd, that looks like that's a bit funny, but I guess these things happen. But then when you look at it, if you actually sort of kind of dig into it, you look into it, actually the Crown Prosecution Service have never done any police officers for manslaughter for that sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? It's like when you start putting them together. I did a programme recently on deaths in police custody, and you start putting the stuff together, it's like, oh, okay, right, no police officer has ever been done for manslaughter since 1965, sort of thing. So, oh, okay, fine. So it's part of a broader picture, and it's the same with this. Like, you might hear about a death in an immigration detention centre, and it might get, but you won't. The report doesn't say, oh yeah, by the way, this is like the third one this year in that one place. You're never given the context. So you might get these odd little bites, and it's kind of, it's one of those pieces of news which is just kind of like, yeah, no, something bad's happening there. They're not supposed to be good places in any way. That sounds a bit dodgy in what that person was doing. You're not given the opportunity to kind of take it within context, and there's so much mixed information is given out. So the Home Office will not release, you know, they're often won't release, they won't say anything's happened. It's only when the newspapers start digging into the case that they go, okay, yeah, fine, all right, this happened. But then even then, it's still like they'll give their version of events, and it's only when you then talk to the detainees and say, well, what happened there? They'll give you a completely different version. So you've got the story is that this guy was in his room and he died of a heart attack on his own. And then when you speak to the guy that was in his cell, actually, no, there were two guys kneeling on his neck at the time. You know, it's completely different stories, and it's just like the culture of disbelief that exists for refugees and asylum seekers. Like, yeah.
Sorry, I had another question about the kind of a legal question. When someone arrives in the country, you gave your experience. Thank you very much for sharing your experiences. Is it illegal to arrive in the country then without your documentation? Is that a...
It used to be acceptable. When I first came in 2004, it used to be, when you were applying for asylum in Apple, I applied in Heathrow. I came from Brazil to Heathrow, and then I applied in there. That used to be acceptable, but, and then the lawyer told me, you are, you know, unfortunately you are not lucky, because they just created, the law just came into force to arrest anyone who come into the country without passport or false passport. Any document that do not belong to you, you will be arrested, you will be put in the detention center. That was the new legislation, 2004. I don't know if it, I think it's still there. Yeah, that's just...
Yeah, they made it a criminal offence.
So it was criminal.
Immigration offences became criminal offences where they hadn't been before. So, yeah, if you destroy your passport or use a false document, you can't be arrested.
I heard a criminal.
Well, that's weird that you were put in... It's still weird that you were put in prison. Yeah. Most people go to immigration detention centre on the fast track, but to actually be imprisoned is...
Yeah, mine was actually criminal offence, and then... Actually, I did check my... It's a CRB. Yeah, and then it came explanation because I failed to present document in Heathrow to the immigration. That was the offence.
The CRB is a criminal record to be able to check. Yeah.
It's
worth bearing in mind that it's not actually possible to legally enter the country to claim asylum.
You can't apply for asylum and come
here legally.
Yeah. The question was, where's your passport? How come you come to there is no way you travel without a passport. Where is your passport? That was a big question. because usually when you come as a refugee, you cannot travel with your own passport. In Brazil, I had help to, you know, because people sell it. sell the whole package and then give you access to go. But if you present that false passport, you will be in trouble. I was instructed to leave it in the plane. That's why when I left the plane, that plane was actually a big plane, Brazilian plane. I remember it was like stopping in London, Copenhagen, and Copenhagen, Oslo. So I was instructed to leave in London. And then, so when I arrived in London, the problem started. And then the immigration said, where's your passport? You have no passport. I said, immigration. I just did not understand because I couldn't speak a word. I had an interpreter from Brazil, a Brazilian, who explained to me. It was more. But there is a very big issue as well. Some organizations are very concerned because when you apply for asylum, if you present your original document, they will deport you. If you do not present, they arrest you. I have no choice. Yeah.
I think just to add to that, because my mother actually worked in the immigration services, and she used to tell me a lot of these stories, and the way they ask questions as well, they phrase questions, and that's why she sort of left that sector, because she couldn't handle it anymore, but the way they are asked to phrase questions is to make a person very unlikely to claim asylum, so the way they sort of, they're almost coached in a way to ask the questions in a certain way, and they said that, if you ask them that way, they'll just claim asylum. So it's their way of sort of sifting through the people who are genuinely claiming asylum or not. But she said that there were so many cases where she felt particularly rotten to send people back in, because she had to conduct the interviews in the back room before they got through. And she said that there are ways that they're sort of trained to answer or ask questions to make sure that people don't claim asylum, or they won't get apparent that it's not possible what they're asking.
And then that goes through every level of it. I think the worst, the most illustrative example is the grant monkey, which is in the office where they make the initial decisions on somebody's asylum application, whether they're going to grant, if somebody's an asylum seeker, they apply to under the Geneva Convention to be allowed to stay in the country as a refugee, and in the office where they make the decisions as to whether or not somebody's going to be granted status or not, the culture is very much to not grant status to anybody. And if one of the workers is found to have granted status to anybody, he gets that they've got a stuffed, I don't know if they still do this, but they've got a stuffed toy called the status, the grant monkey, and they would put it on the top of his computer and they'd go, "Ah, you gave somebody status, you're the status monkey," and they would have that on top of their computer for the rest of the day. So it was this thing, it's like we're talking about this pervasive culture of disbelief. I mean, it's quite, it is systematic. You're encouraged not to believe anybody, to not let anybody slip through, kind of thing, to prevent everybody every turn. And you're humiliated if you don't.
I previously studied international law and international politics, and then it came, across so many issues, especially this country is violating. Is breaching the convention, the 1951 convention, asylum, to grant people to apply for asylum. UK signed it, most of countries signed it. Even if you come with a false passport or with your passport, if you are genuinely explained to them about your situation, they must have to grant you. They don't have to arrest you because that is a human rights violation.
Can I ask Stephen a slightly provocative question? We have a free press in this country, and there's been a lot topically recently about how free. Do you think, and I believe that most people are not intrinsically bad or intrinsically biased against one another. How much of the culture, the pervasive culture of disbelief, the pervasive culture you were saying about the training of people to reject anybody coming in, the figures Bryony showed us earlier about the public fear of immigration, how much of that do you think is whipped up by tabloid media for sensationalism, but in fact doesn't look responsibly at the consequences? And as a media person, should we be addressing this in a different way?
Well, I mean, in all fairness, I ought to reveal my own bias in this, because that's largely why I started doing this in the first place, was just because I actually had friends who were refugees, and I was aware of their situation in the UK and their experiences abroad, and then I was just comparing that to what I was hearing on a daily basis in the media, what I was seeing on the front pages of particularly the Daily Mail and the Sun, but also stories on BBC coverage and things like that, and it just didn't fit. It just was like, well, no, they're not. This isn't happening. This isn't my experience. This isn't, none of these people are bogus benefit scrounging terrorists. It just seemed like this just feels flat out wrong. And this is one of these classic underdog kind of situations. Nobody's, you know, these people have been clearly scapegoated, you know, clearly being blamed for all the ills of society, and everything's being laid at their door, and essentially, like, well, it just seemed it was the inaccuracy of it more than the malignancy of it. It was just simply not the case. This isn't what is motivating people, and I felt the only way to redress it was, yeah, through the media, through doing our own media, through a type of media that gave people back the thing that was being taken away from them, and that was really their humanity. Failing to do that,
I suppose my argument was more that I think they'll buy the papers no matter what the papers say. And actually, for as long as we keep addressing, because the media has whipped up this largely falsified hysteria about migration being the cause of all the ills, until somebody stands up and says, hey, wake up, smell the coffee, it's not, then efforts will, you know, you're still fighting, you're pushing the boulder uphill. We have to do both, surely, which is sort of say, wake up, smell the coffee, guys, it's not about. And there have been one or two efforts to do that.
I remember when I, 2008, in Portsmouth, I worked for an organization called Refugee Action, and I used to run school by school from 7 years old to 12 years old, and meeting community leaders, business, try to, you know, give them awareness about refugee people. Me and my boss, my manager, and I used to, you know, I really loved that, especially with the kids. And they were so interested to understand why people come to this country, the reasons. And they asked me amazing questions. I remember a girl, I think she was 7 years old, she said to me that, oh yeah, my dad said that these people come here to live on benefit and to take away our jobs. Very intelligent girl. And then she said, and now I believe that not everybody, you know, is the same. And then also, when I arrived in Portsmouth, we were, I think, a group of 100 refugees from different African countries. And it was very difficult to see black people in Portsmouth. And then a few weeks after, then it came from the local paper saying that the robbery and, you know, and stealing is increasing since refugees and asylum seekers arrived in Portsmouth. These people need to be removed from Portsmouth. And yeah, that was in the local paper. So, but it was the work that I did. We target young, you know, children, you know, those people who already were poisoned. But we went to school and, you know, and I had to present a video from a small girl from Congo. She also lost her parents as well. And she was rejected because, you know, Africa is actually, African country, they have got many cultures and languages. And she, if you are from one part of the country and then you move to, you're going to be rejected because you cannot speak that language. we're not going to fit in that culture. And the girl was rejected until she found a safe place. And I think upset kids. Kids start to cry. I was, wow, I said, I'm in trouble now. And then it affected them emotionally. Yeah. But it was a very good job that I had done.
Thank you very much, both of you, for coming in. You said the aim is to sort of bring that individual story, and I feel you've definitely done that today and brought alive a lot of things that we've talked about through the course of the term, so thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
You have been listening to a special edition of the Refugee Radio Show. There will now be a live Q&A session on our Facebook page with members of the Resilience panel. So if you have any questions about the programme today or about the issues raised, please head on over to Facebook and get involved in the discussion yourself. You can find us by googling the words Refugee Radio Facebook or by going to the Facebook site and searching for Refugee Radio. There is also a link on our own website at www.refugeeradio.org.uk.
Thanks for listening, and I look forward to catching you over on Facebook in a minute.
Every day, if you want to post any questions after the session, up until the end of June.